My name is Ralph Yarrell. I'm 89 years old.
You're a kid.
And today is the 22nd of January. And I'm speaking with Faye Woolrich, who is my very old friend. We're recording this interview in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Faye, can you tell me a little bit about your childhood? What were you like as a child?
Mouthy.
Okay.
No, when I was six, my older sister, 7 years older, came home from public school. And there was an evangelist there saying that in public school, you get that, if they didn't join his church, they were going to hell.
Ooh.
And I said, well, I'm not joining his church, and I'm not going to hell either. And so I've...
You didn't accept either premise.
No, I did not. So, you were asking earlier about what I was born into.
Yes.
Is this jumping that question?
No, that's fine.
Okay. Well, my father had practiced law for 11 years and then went into the Methodist ministry.
Oh.
And I was born in this little town south of Dallas where he had a three-point circuit. And there were cotton fields, this little burg, you know. And I think I was just 6 weeks old when we moved to Fort Worth for a couple of years in Georgetown, Texas for six, which was unusual in the Methodist church. Then San Angelo for one, then to Austin where we live. My dad was there for 25 years. So my life growing up in Austin was shaped by church, the state government, and the University of Texas. They were all right there. And at that time, there was a quorum of the state Supreme Court and the membership of church, lots of faculty members and attorneys and stuff. It was a good place to grow up. Now Austin's a progressive enclave in this extremely conservative state, which shames me, but I'm stuck with it. So I,
was there anything about your dad's training as an attorney that you think affected him or you? In those days?
It affected his presentation.
That's interesting.
When he preached, he did not use a manuscript. I mean, he was prepared, but he spoke to the people. In fact, one Sunday, one of his friends, who was one of the Supreme Court judges, leaned over and asked his wife, what did he say? And my father repeated it, and he nodded his head, and they went right ahead. So it's nice to be able to have contact. Yeah, I was influenced, I'm sure, a lot by my dad. When Paul was overseas in the Navy and I was living at home working while he was gone.
When you say at home, was that in Texas?
Austin, yeah.
In Austin, okay.
One Sunday, this nice-looking, well-dressed black man came to the door with a bouquet of flowers, and I invited him to come in. He said, oh, no, but just tell your father that in East Austin, we sleep better when he's in the pulpit. So, and then a couple of years before gas rationing, so that would have been...
40, 39?
Yeah, the late 39. Like we moved into that house in 39. At 6:30 in the morning, there were two flatbed trucks that pulled up with students from Houston Tillotson University, which is a black college. My dad was on the board for about 25 years. And they climbed out and stood in our front yard and sang Christmas carols to my dad, but the rest of us got to hear it. Which was a real special treat
Wow.
for me and made a big impression.
So there was, it was being liberal on race was extra fine because it was in a conservative area. And then he was a pioneer, basically, it sounds like.
Well, he was a Presbyterian early on. And that's okay with you, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
But he took 1 year off from university to travel, trying to raise money for the University Presbyterian Church. He wasn't very good at it, but he had some interesting experiences doing that. But my parents lived in Temple, where he was practicing law. And there were two Presbyterian churches across the street from each other, one northern, one southern. And that was not healthy. So he was chairman of a committee to try to bring these two together. Well, the committee worked it out. Both ministers would need to leave and bring in one new person. One guy refused to leave, and so Daddy thought that was time to become a Methodist, which my mother was. So. And that worked out okay. But we were Presbyterians once in Logan, Utah. Ralph's Presbyterian.
She's trying to get my goat a little bit.
No, we're very ecumenical and we work together.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I lived in Tuscaloosa, Alabama in the 40s, I went to a Presbyterian church that had as a minister somebody very, very liberal on race. And
isn't that refreshing?
Yeah, well, in that setting.
Yeah.
It was.
I remember you took the train up to go to school in Michigan by yourself at, what, 14?
I think so, yeah. You've read my book.
I've talked. I've listened.
Can you tell me about your grandparents?
Yeah, my German grandparents, my father's parents, were both born in this country. My grandmother was the daughter of a slave owner. He had one slave. And my grandfather's father was very anti-slavery. So there was a party one night at her house, and her younger brother said, if you want to marry Charlie, this is your chance to get away. So she put on all the clothes she could wear and walked several miles in the dark to the home where her to-be husband lived. And of course she was disowned by her father. And they were married and were living in Fayetteville, Texas, which is reputed to have the least quality of any town in the country. It's just nothing. But after my dad was born, she noticed her father walking up and down in front of the house on the street, so she went and she said, Papa, wouldn't you like to come in? So he did, and they were able to reestablish a relationship.
Oh, wonderful.
But I, you know, and this...
And she reached out.
Yeah. In my knowing her, though, she was a very passive lady, which was hard for me to respect. But obviously she wasn't passive earlier.
Or at least in that circumstance.
Yeah. My mother's parents were from Scotch-Irish-English breed, and she was a Kirk and went back to the Magna Carta and all that good stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And her husband, Grimes, came over from Scotch-Irish, that group. But they were farm people, and... we have Civil War letters written by my great-grandmother, who was her mother, and they're just priceless.
You have them still? You have them here at Friendship?
Yeah, we have them in the safety deposit box of the bank. Mm-hmm. But they're handwritten, of course, and, you know, using the borders and everything because paper was precious. But she wrote one time, my grandfather was not great-grandfather was not a happy camper. He was in the Civil War. And there was nothing good about that. And they didn't have slaves. His parents did, and his grandparents had, and we've traced those through the inheritance. But
sounds like you've done some work in that area.
Beg pardon?
It sounds like you've done some work.
Well, it was fun. But she wrote this one letter that when he came home, she wanted him to put a floor in that house. It was hard to keep two little girls clean on a dirt floor. And then there'd be a letter about, you know, and the letter would go when somebody was going back to the front to carry it. And one time he wrote and he said the reason he had time was because they stopped to do laundry, but his clothes had been stolen, so he didn't have any laundry to do. But he had found a tent and he was making some clothes out of that. And so she wrote back and he had a loom, a blanket on the loom she was weaving for him, and she was knitting him some socks. And she was making some shirts, and that somebody would take them back when they went. So those were just priceless stories to hear.
Sure are.
And when they were in Arkansas, but they could hear the fighting over in Vicksburg across the river. So, you know, that's pretty heavy, just like all wars, I guess. But those were interesting things.
Wonderful. The next question is the one about your sharing a memory of me. I don't know don't take much time with that, but you said it was okay if I asked you if you have a favorite.
Well, you know, some of the things that you did as a kid, traveling up from Tuscaloosa to go to school, I think that's mind-boggling at age 14 or something.
Well, it was during the war, and hitchhiking was more in favor then.
But at 14, that would you have been approved by parents to hitchhike?
I was.
Okay.
They were aware of it.
So I thought you took the train.
I did another time.
Oh, okay.
There were different times. I was in school in Michigan, and my parents lived in Alabama.
Yeah.
And I had to get back and forth 6 or 7 times, yeah. I think, or maybe more.
Well, I know Paul did hitchhiking at different times.
Yeah. Can you tell me about one or two people that have been a big influence on your life?
Let me interrupt and throw back another memory.
Okay.
A few months ago, I was looking at the video of Paul's memorial service at church, and everybody was 16 or 17 years younger. And you and Joanne looked so young.
We were just kids all along.
You were.
I've always thought about Paul, and maybe you and Paul, as being a little wiser and older. I don't know why. How old are you?
I'm 93, so I'm have you by 4 years. Yeah.
So there you are. A couple people that have had a big influence on you. Can you pick out one or two?
Well, I was saying my dad for one.
Okay, I can understand that.
And Paul, my husband. He was a keeper.
Are there any positive moments or memories from your life that you think shaped who you are today? Did something happen to you that made you who you are?
I think my life was pretty positive all the way through.
I expect that that's because you're a positive person. So much of it depends on your attitude, and you sure have a strong
attitude's positive. Another thing I like. It does make a difference. And I'm just lucky you have a positive attitude.
I once heard the phrase attitude or gratitude, and I kind of like the
mix,
line.
They go well together.
They don't do it the
yeah. way.
How about a lesson? Can you remember a lesson in life that you, a lesson? I had finders keepers.
I can remember when we lived in Georgetown. I was between 2 and 8 at that time. We'd gone into a neighbor's house and there was a bowl of candy sitting there, and I took a piece. I was not invited to do that. Well, of course, I had to go back and apologize and all that good stuff. So I think I started learning early there are things you don't do.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. How about something that you're proud of? Personally, professionally? When we talked earlier, you talked about volunteer experience.
Well, when the kids were getting on so that there wasn't so much, they were in college or high school. And I thought it'd be nice to find something to do that I thought was worthwhile. And there are a lot of good programs in Kalamazoo, and I tried a couple, but they weren't good for me. And then I had latched into learning to translate textbooks into Braille, and I just loved that.
Really?
Particularly the math code. There was a beauty about that. So I did that about 20 years.
That's interesting. I think I knew that, but I had forgotten until mm-hmm. you mentioned it. But isn't it interesting that you you were interested in blindness early on?
Well, Becky, our third daughter, did her bachelor's in special ed for the blind and did her student teaching with George Osinchuk. But when she was in high school, she volunteered with George. But I don't know that her involvement affected me. When we moved to Kalamazoo, I met Dorothy Osborne and Mary Bullock, whose husband, Don Bullock, was head of the music department and started the Bullock Brass Group.
Mm-hmm.
They had been transcribing, and I met them at a circle meeting. I thought, hey, that sounds like something interesting, and I could do that at home. And Joe Mason, you may have known.
Yeah.
Chris and Frank Steele lived in their house 1 year when they were sailing around the world.
They occupied their house for a year. Yeah, I remember that.
But Joe was teaching the classes, so we'd go to her house one day a week, and then we'd turn in our assignments. At the end of the year, we transcribed, I think, 45 pages of some book and submitted that to the Library of Congress. And you had to make, I've forgotten the span, I think I made 85. But enough that I was able to be certified. And that was just, it was great.
That's a whole part of your life I never knew.
And then the other thing that I loved doing was delivering meals on wheels.
Was what?
Delivering meals on wheels.
Oh, yeah.
Which I did for 41 years. That was fun.
We question on gratitude. We've talked about attitude. Mm-hmm. This question is if you can remember something for which you are most grateful.
Daughters, for one.
Oh, four lovely daughters.
And their kids, they're different as night and day, but they're very forgiving, have forgiven me the things I should have done and didn't, the things I did and shouldn't. And we all like each other, so that's great. I've got a lot of gratitude. I'm grateful every day for being right here in Friendship Village.
Can you tell me about the dumbest thing you ever did?
Oh, there are a lot of those.
I'll bet. Probably thousands. Maybe millions.
Needing to wear duct tape on my mouth when I didn't, you know. And that's a family joke, but... trying to keep my mouth shut when I should.
Really?
Yeah. When Joe's second granddaughter was being baptized, and I won't tell you in what church, but it's very conservative. And I was behaving myself. I really was. I was just sitting there participating. But the preacher was talking about original sin, which I think is the dumbest thing I ever heard of. And she drew a picture of me with tape across my mouth and passed it down the road. So from then on, we've joked about duct tape. But
so that really happened?
Yeah. She thought about buying me plaid duct tape or colored and stuff, but we talk about that a lot. I work on it.
Is there any kind of a secret thing that you've never told me or many people? Is there, you want to tell a little secret to this tape?
Probably not.
Oh, okay. How has your life been different than how you imagined it when you were young? I mean, has there been some surprises?
I don't know that I imagined it when I was young.
Sort of play the cards that are dealt to you.
Well, and you know, I live in the present, so maybe I did that when I was younger too. And I don't worry about the past, and I don't sweat the small stuff if I can manage, and I don't sweat too much about the future. Sometimes I worry about some of my grandkids. They're great, but, you know, life can be hard sometimes.
Is something going on with any of them right now that just makes you worry extra? I mean,
yeah, but I don't think I want to say one of them.
Okay.
Because they may listen to this.
Strong chance, yeah. Actually.
Nick's family is, it's not worry, but, I mean, the pressure they're under is pretty heavy. He's finishing his master's in March, I think. And he's, I think, submitting his 180-page thesis. Plus, he has a full-time job and a family he tries to not ignore. And lots of volunteer work. So,
are there still some gigs?
No, but he plans to get back into the business. Well, I take that back. When they have fundraisers for the Hanna Institute, where he's assistant director. And the Institute is their research branch of the Hanna Center, and there's a Hanna Boys School, ages 12 to 17, who are considered at risk. There are 100 of those. And
Who classifies that? Who puts that label
on?
I
don't know that. This had a Catholic beginning, and I don't know whether it still is or not. I think this last year their fundraiser raised $260,000, I think. I may be wrong on that.
Okay.
But Nick and Shannon were both at the Transcendence Theater in Sonoma, California. Nick had been there a year earlier, and she had too at different times. But they were there together for a couple of years before he left to do this other. So when they're doing these fundraisers, he pulls in some of those actors to give their time. And he was telling me that, you know, if they're being reluctant, he reminds them how the community supports the theaters, and it would be nice for them to give back. So he and Shannon...
He reminded his friends to say little bit of payback time coming in. Yeah.
Well, and he and Shannon have developed a 501c3.
Really?
And they do scholarships for students, and she was a dancer on Broadway and national tours and worked in India with Nick for 6 months. And, of course, You know what he did. And then he was in India for three different times, total close to 2 years. And so they loved that. But they worked with outcasts or slum kids in India. And of the 30 that were involved in there, you know, I've been trying to get that DVD of the Maya Project, and I still don't have it. And Nick says it's, but someday I'm going to get it. But he was able to get a $25,000 grant to have a mask maker come from Portland, Oregon, to do the masks for the show. But of the 30 kids they worked with...
In India?
In India.
Uh-huh.
They've been able to get scholarships for 8 of them, which I think is pretty exciting.
And where does the scholarship bring them?
Well...
Are they still in India?
Some are, and some aren't. Priyanka... who some years ago, he said when she was 40, he'd vote for her for prime minister. They got her a scholarship to a school in, I think it was Trieste, Italy. And that was sort of a culture shock in a way, but she's a bright, bright gal. She was one of the leads in the Maya Project. Currently, she's in the States working on a degree. There's one kid they got a scholarship for in Thailand. One, I think, in Singapore. I mean, you know, different places.
In the world.
Yeah.
In the world of life.
And Shilpa, who is somebody he knew when she was in eighth grade, his first trip to India was to Shantibhavan, which is 80 kilometers south of Bangalore. And that school was founded by a Dr. George, who was Indian, but he came to the States and did well financially and felt that every child, no matter what color they are, she got a good education. So he went back to India, and he started this school. And they would go to villages and select young kids who had potential and could benefit. The school provided housing, food, clothing, education, everything free. They would only take one child from a family. And Shilpa lived in this little village. And her stories, she has written a book which was published by the George Foundation. And she's has done a master's in Bangalore. And I don't know whether she's in this country working on a doctorate or she wants to be. But her book is amazing, and he sent me a copy of that if you're ever wanting something to read. But all that goes into that, and of course the financial hits, and he almost had to close the school. But so anyhow, they've been part of this sort of thing. But after Nick finishes his master's, he wants to get back in the business. So he would be teaching theater, hopefully in some university.
Well, about how old would he be then?
Well, he was born in 1980. So he's 38 now.
Yeah.
So he'd be 39.
Finishes that thesis, he'll be 38, 40-ish, something
yeah.
like that.
He'll be 39 in June, yeah. Mm-hmm. And his wife, Shannon, spent a year in Bali studying meditation and dance. And she teaches meditation classes. She also is yoga certified. She teaches yoga and then dance classes. And their 501c3 provides scholarships to some of these. And I think Nick was doing a music theater performance class over there. So they've got their fingers into an awful lot of things going on.
International things, I mean.
Yeah.
Global.
And, you know, the fires in their area a year ago, October, presented lots of PTSD for the people living. They were evacuated for a couple of weeks. And the National Guard had built a berm behind their little house because the fires were just 1 or 2 miles away.
Just one berm away.
Yeah. And so Nick was making runs down with food and water and masks and stuff. So, but that's affected the whole area. You know, they've had friends whose house survived, but the one across the water burned. So, I mean, that's, anyhow, he has become certified as a trauma care provider.
Really?
And then presented a paper in Detroit at the International Institute of Restorative Practices. This is a program developed to work with the people who've had these problems. And they have a dance program called, I think it's Rainbow Dance, for 2 and 3 year olds that have been dealing with. Have you heard of ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences?
No.
The Family Children Program here in Kalamazoo works with that. And we've had programs on that over here. And so that, you know, it works with all of these. And I took the test, and I have no bad experiences. I'm lucky. But so they're involved in all this, and I just hope they survive.
I don't know what you mean by took the test. You mean you...
Oh, there is a little test that ACES has, you know, questions about your childhood. And did you have people that yelled at you all frequently or all the time?
I see.
Or were you abused physically, or were you without food, you know? And I've not had any of those experiences, so...
Well, that's because you were so lucky.
I am lucky.
I'm interested in Shannon. What an interesting combination of...
She is from Louisville, Kentucky, and went to a special theater school, and she went to... Oh, I just lost the name.
That's okay.
It's a theater school in New York. It doesn't give degrees, so she's finished her degree since then. She had... Did you see White Christmas, the movie, a year or so ago?
Well, I saw it. Yeah, well, 30 years ago.
Rosemary Clooney, and then I've forgotten it, but the real dancer, Judy, is the role that Shannon played for 7 years.
Oh, okay.
And they took that to Moscow, but that was during the Chechnya situation, and they had to leave after 6 months. Her mother is from a very large family whose father died young. Her father had his own company, but I think he was an adjunct professor in art at Michigan State, where another granddaughter-in-law got her master's. But when George and I went to Louisville for a baby shower for Shannon before Indy was born, one of her aunts, who's a principal of a school, came over and was visiting with me and Shannon's grandmother. We were having our wine and a good conversation in the corner. And she said she had told Shannon not to move back there because she said, you know, you and Nick are used to living in other cultures, and you would not be able to raise your child here the way you want to. And I thought, that was a very wise thing to say, and surprising, because that's from a Catholic background, I think. Maybe it's the father. Anyhow, I thought that was interesting. Neat family.
You've got a lot of neat families in your mm-hmm. world.
Lucky again.
Yeah. Providential, maybe. How would you like to be remembered?
Kindly. Kindly.
Kindly? What kindly recollections?
Well, I just like not to leave too many bad memories.
You've got enough packed in there so that you should be able to come up with two or three sort of wise comments.
I'm not very wise.
I beg to differ. Yeah, I notice you mentioned kindness and compassion.
I think I am, but I hadn't thought about being remembered that way.
Well, that's interesting. So you're not doing it for show.
Hopefully not.
Okay. Do you have any tattoos?
No. Do I want any? No.
Do you have any regrets?
Yes. I told you I had one.
Okay.
And that's when Paul was dealing with metastatic lung cancer. And Marge Hastings and other kids, you know, you've got to get out. You've got to get out. Well, friends of ours, the Fenwicks, that you may or may not have met, but part of the Alabama bunch, were having a brunch. And so Paul had gone somewhere for a medical thing, and I'd, you know, picked up meds and used the juicer to get something that soothed him. And so I thought, well, I'll run over for the party. I wish I hadn't. I didn't need to do that. But I was, you know, people were saying, you got to get out. But then I got to think, maybe Paul would have told me if he didn't want me to. Because when he was in the hospital with pneumonia, 6 months before he died, he went in the middle of the night Friday because he was so stubborn. He wouldn't go in sooner.
He went in too late.
Well,
later than he might have.
I was wanting to call the doctor. You know, he was running a temp of 101 or something at noon. And he said, no, he was just so tired of doctors. So, but when he couldn't breathe about 7:30 in the evening, he didn't argue anymore. And so I called the oncologist, and she asked which hospital I wanted. And she said, well, get him down there. So, they hooked him up, you know, to monitors in the ER and stuff. And about 2 o'clock they called her, and she said, put him in. So Georgia had a show going out in South Haven then, and Joe had helped work on costumes. So Joe and Mark had gone out to see the show, so I left a note for them. So his only apology was later, if I had listened to you, you wouldn't be up so late. But anyhow, okay, on Sunday I went down to see him, and I had on clean jeans and a plaid shirt, and we had a special music program coming to church. And I said, well, if you don't mind, I'm going to run across the park. And he said, I'd rather you stay here. So maybe he would have told me if he didn't want me to go.
Sounds like it.
But I was feeling later, I wish I hadn't done that. But if that's my only regret, I don't have any.
It sounds kind of minor to me. It might not even be worth regretting.
It wasn't minor to me at the time.
I understand. A lot of the times when I think about regrets, I think about roughly the time my wife died.
But you know,
a lot of if onlys there. But
you can't do that. But let me remind you of all the support you gave Joanne for years. And she knew that with the diabetes and the vision and all that. You were right there helping her.
Yeah, but it's
making life as good as you could. You can't do more than that. Well, I'll be your Jewish grandmother and fuss at you.
It sort of sounds like it. What are your hopes and wishes for your children? Have you got something you'd like them to...
The grandkids. My kids, I think, are pretty... We don't always agree, but that's okay. We can agree to disagree and not beat each other over with it. But I would hope that the lives of my grandkids... And, you know, when Paul died, I would have been happy to have died with him. But I would have missed knowing what happened to the grandkids. And they are great and different as night and day. There are 4 that are rocket scientists and 2 that learn differently, but are great, great people.
I like that phrase, learn differently.
Well, we're getting a little bit smarter about that, don't you think?
I really do.
You know, earlier, if you didn't learn that way, you were dumb. That's not true.
Yeah, it sounds like I'm kind of picking on you a little bit now, but
I can always say no.
I'll read the whole question. Thinking about your family many generations from now, and knowing that they may be hearing this recording, is there anything you want to say to them? Any wisdom or advice you'd like to share? I know I've asked it before, but I thought maybe if you'd think about it again.
Just sending some love and hugs.
Hugs, huh? Mm-hmm. Hugs are good.
Hugs are really good. Be true to yourself.
I like that. I'm on a kind of a truth kick. And I can't remember if we've... I'm sort of against Santa Claus lately because it involves lying to your children and being true to yourself and being true to your kids. And
that's a sticky balance, isn't it?
It's what?
A sticky balance.
Yeah.
You know, there's another thing that I think was put in the Villager some years ago, this little thing about truth that I came from my dad's file somewhere. Sort of like an antiseptic, you know, it may hurt, but it cleanses.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to a minister yesterday, and he said, truth with love, and you can do that. So the truth's important.
I think sometimes it's a little hard to love if there's a breach in truth. If you're not trustworthy, it's kind of hard to be loved, I think.
When you lose trust, it's hard to regain that,
yeah,
if you ever can.
So there you go. I think you and I just had some wisdom and advice that we just gave.
Well, we're wise beyond our years.
Maybe.